listening to Zentertainment Talk Radio on the web at www.zentertainment.org. My name is Joe Davidson. I'm so excited to have Ashok Gupta back today to answer your questions. If you haven't listened to last week's interview yet, I suggest that you start there. I highly recommend that. And you can do that on the show page at zentertainment.org. Also, make sure to sign up for the newsletter, and you can download these episodes by signing up on iTunes on the show page at zentertainment.org. You can find out more about Ashok and his program at guptaprogramme.com. Well, Ashok, hi. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, great to be here.
I decided to share something personal today. I wasn't sure if I wanted to do it, and I'll just kind of keep it brief because I don't want to trigger anybody and go deep into the details. But I think that in sharing this, it'll give Ashok a chance to respond, and my hope is that it will help those of you who have dealt with traumatic situations in your life that could be impacting your health. We all have a lot of different triggers, and traumas can be large and small. So this is actually just one of mine. One of many, but this day, September 11th, generally is really hard for me. It has been every year. And I purposely booked this interview at 9 a.m. because I wanted something in the time frame between about 8:45 and 9:15 where I would be distracted. And I've also had a pretty much a media blockout today. I spent some time in the ocean, saw a friend, and just doing really positive things. You know, 14 years ago, I was in New York City, and I did hear the first plane hit that first tower, and it woke me up and saw everything else happen from either my window or I was right outside on the street, and I watched both towers fall. There was a lot of chemical exposure over a very prolonged period of time mixed with a lot of very intense emotions in Lower Manhattan and all the stuff that, you know, you all have heard about. In that particular thing, the media brings it up every single year. Today, even the weather feels like it did then, exactly actually like it did that day. So it re-triggers a lot of the same feelings. So I'm sharing that to give Ashok a chance to respond to help any of you who have dealt with trauma.
There's some really interesting research on how we form memories, which is absolutely relevant to what you're talking about now. So let me just briefly talk about that. And in fact, I was going to send a message out about that to everyone doing the retraining. So this is very relevant. You're mentioning it now. Basically, when we go through a certain experience, if the experience is full of a certain emotion, so that might be fear, anger, or even a very happy experience, we're more likely to create deep grooves in our minds. So that's deep neuronal connections which stay. And then what happens is, let's say the emotion is fear. Then what happens, because it's such a deep groove in the mind, whenever we go through life and we are reminded of anything similar to that memory, we re-trigger the experience of that memory as if it was happening today. Which is why for some people, 9/11, if they were in it or experienced it or they knew somebody who was in it, they may have a re-triggering of the fear that they experienced, you know, 14 years ago. Now, what some latest neuroscientific research is showing is that actually those memories degrade over time depending on the context in which we bring them up again. And so when we bring up a memory, but we do something else at the same time, we change the emotional context of that memory. So if you think about, for instance, let's say psychotherapy, let's say we were to treat trauma through psychotherapy, that would be a kind of more long-term psychotherapy approach where we would talk out that particular experience and hope that by talking it out, somehow we'll be able to reduce the emotional impact of that memory. Yeah, but we're now finding that there are other techniques such as EFT, which is emotional freedom technique, the tapping technique, which seem to work quicker and more directly on the traumas. And in the same way, by remembering the trauma repeatedly and doing something different, which is tapping, we gradually degrade the emotional context of that memory until it no longer bothers us. If you look at EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization reprogramming, repatterning, I think. That technique is all about reliving the memory, the emotion, and changing the movements of your eyes.
Right.
And in the accelerator technique, in amygdala retraining program, what I get people to do is to actually recall the particular emotional memory and then go into a surrender technique where they're deliberately learning to let it go. And within minutes, people find that deep down emotions or negativities seem to reduce and they seem to have a lasting effect, unless they re-trigger the emotion and deliberately think about it in a negative way again. We sometimes confuse letting go and moving on with compromising our memory of the people who passed away. And so I feel that at some point, when people have been through difficult times or there's been a tragedy, it is about the media, society, beginning to learn to heal those wounds and let things go, rather than looking to recreate and reenact those situations and those emotions again within people. And we have to remember that the media is designed, at some level, it's not doing it consciously, but our media is designed unconsciously to stimulate our emotions, to keep us riveted to our screens, right, so that they sell more advertising. And that's how it works.
Yeah. Well, let's go into some questions here. Now, one of the questions, this is related to what we're talking about. The accelerator technique is so fantastic in your program. A lot of people have written me, they do not have that supplemental workshop 6A CD. And I wondered if you sell that separately or could make that available.
Yes, it is sold separately. So if they just email our clinic saying they want 6A and 6B, then they can be sent the accelerator pack for sure.
Okay. What is that email? Can you just tell us that?
Yes, it's info@guptaprogram. And as compared to the English spelling, the American spelling just has one M at the end, but the English spelling is double M-E at the end. So it's info@guptaprogram.com.
Great. Okay, so questions. So we're just going to dive right in, Q&A time. So somebody wrote and they said, when will day 15 onwards, the meaning of life videos and meditations be ready?
We are working on them right now, and we hope to launch all of the videos kind of November, December time. So those will be the beta testers, and our full global launch of the app and all the videos and meditations will be in January. But obviously that's a separate project to the Gupta program.
This person said, could Ashok please do a webinar where he reviews the new round process in detail?
Webinar 2 of each webinar series does spend about an hour to an hour and a half on the new techniques, the tools and techniques. So if they want to rewatch that video and the recording of that webinar number 2. And if they have any further questions, just email our clinic and we'll do what we can to support that. And it gives us feedback as to what else we need to include in that webinar.
So someone said, I struggle with making my visualizations vivid, especially when I'm dealing with more severe fatigue and brain fog. Are there any other ways to get into a positive state? Do you have any suggestions?
Imagine you are on a boat in the middle of a storm. Yep. When the storm is really powerful and really hard, all you can do is be as centered as possible. And actually, as much as possible, you reduce the negative thoughts, but you just need to float through it because they're coming thick and fast like a storm. Yeah. Now, so that's fine. If you're feeling you're overflowing with negative patterns and negative signals from the body, then you just float through it, meditate, do the soften and flow, relax. Now, once the storm is gone, or the worst of the storm is gone, if you are then in the middle of the storm thinking, well, the storm is gone, but gosh, wasn't that a horrible storm? And I hope that storm doesn't come back. And I really don't like that storm. That's when you can go into the retraining processes. The harder you try and push, then actually you're creating resistance and negativity. The purpose of imagination is for it to be as easygoing as possible. So whatever you manage to imagine as feeling healthy is good enough. And if you can't imagine yourself healthy, think of someone else that you know who is healthy and strong and imagine how they might feel. Okay, so there's lots of little tools and tricks that you can use to visualize better, but don't push or resist it or try too hard. So you can do this full 7-step process. Physically, you can do it in your head. There's then the short version. There's a short version. So yes, sometimes if you don't have time to do the full versions, then you can do the shorter versions. And sometimes if there's a repetitive pattern, you do the longer version and then support it with some quick fire short ones towards the end.
Someone wrote in and asked, do dips always result from specific stress or overdoing it? Are they always in my control?
No. Sometimes they are, and that's why for a few minutes, we might reflect on why the dip has occurred and look at our pacing schedule, but then let it go. Sometimes we don't know. So we don't want to go into detective work to try and figure it out. Sometimes dips occur and there's no obvious reason why they have, and we just need to float through it and keep retraining.
Someone said, how can I use posture to tell my body I am well?
Postures that reflect healing are open postures. So when we are leaned, when we lean forward and we put our arms too much in front of our body, it's a defensive posture. The posture of health is actually a surrendered posture where we might be sitting or standing up with our palms faced upwards, which is how we meditate, you know, loosely in our laps, but faced upwards, and just our shoulders back, showing that we're not resisting life, but we're open to life. And that is a healing posture.
That's wonderful. How can I use the steps when I'm in the middle of food sensitivity reactions? Not something life-threatening, but still difficult.
Right. So with food sensitivities and MCS, what we recommend is you use the tools before, during, and after an episode. So if you're in the middle of an episode, people have described two ways that you can handle that. If you're having a reaction right now, you can try the seven-step process, and then at step six, you move to actually imagining health in the body and imagine yourself eating that particular food, feeling healthy. Other people have done a soften and flow process, which is in the program, which is a mindfulness technique, that actually, as the symptoms arise, as you're eating, you just take a couple of minutes out to calm the nervous system as a way of informing your brain that this is not dangerous and there's no need to create a reaction.
Okay, somebody wrote in, this is actually something I've gone through, so I'm curious to hear your answer as well. She said, there has been a death in my family. Can you give me some ideas on how I can retrain and support myself during this time?
Yes. When we're going through grief, we recognize that we don't want to use the stop technique, I mean, the amygdala retraining, on the actual symptoms of grief themselves. So we want to differentiate the two. And when we're going through grief, as we all know, it's very important to talk it out with friends, family, or even a counselor, a bereavement counselor, to be able to talk out the emotions that we are experiencing and make sure that we're not repressing those despite us, you know, going through the retraining. So it's very important to have that support and allow ourselves to experience those emotions and experience that grief so it can be exhausted out of our system. You know, in ancient Indian cultures, Asian cultures, what they do is they have 12 days of mourning, and on the 13th day, they're not allowed to mourn anymore. And what they do is in those first 12 days, they really deliberately bring up as much emotion as they can, and they'll get together and have crying episodes and talk about how horrible everything is. And they get it all out of their system in a concentrated period of 12 days. So on the 13th day, it's a celebration of that person's life.
Wow, that's really interesting, because in our culture, there's a lot of stopping the grief or trying to be strong through the grief, and then some tears, and then trying to be, quote, strong again.
Yes, and this is very interesting. I mean, I'd love to talk to you about this as a separate conversation, but you see, as I mentioned at the beginning, we have a difficulty in handling grief because we have a difficulty in handling loss. And that's not just loss in terms of death, but loss in terms of other things. And if we can actually learn to connect with those emotions and allow them to flood out of our system in shorter periods of time, then the relief will come. And a lot of work that I do with people who've been traumatized or been through difficult times in their past is allowing them to experience emotions safely in a hypnotic state that they have not dealt with or have not been expressed in the past. And death is something where we can deliberately decide to spend time bringing up emotions, deliberately talking about it and getting out of our system, and then the relief will come.
This whole thing of when you go deep into the emotion, then it can trigger more limbic system, amygdala types of responses, making the condition worse. So how do people go deep into that level of grief and still not completely fall apart physically when they're dealing with these conditions?
Right. So this is where there's a differentiation between the emotions that the limbic system is triggering as a result of the condition and emotions in general in the mind, which are there because of a particular incident in someone's life. And I do believe that when we've been through a difficult time or an emotional shock, having the support of a practitioner is important because they can help you through that differentiation. I disagree with that view that going deeper into emotion will somehow make the condition worse. It only makes it worse if you are dwelling in the emotion and getting bogged down by the emotion. But if you are tuning into emotions and then choosing to release them and do something active with them, then that is a different story.
And I guess there are times in grief, too, when you do get bogged down and it does feel pretty overwhelming. So, but that's part of the process of going through grief.
And that's why support comes in, that all of us need a little help sometimes. So as strong as we feel that we want to be, or our egos feel that we can handle it ourselves, doesn't matter how strong you are, it is important to get the support of family and friends to talk it out, or a guide or mentor or an actual counselor to talk it out. And not, you know, sometimes we stop ourselves because we think we're not being strong, or we think there's something wrong with us, but everyone can benefit from a little help.
Somebody wrote and said, I felt much better when I was pregnant, but now I've relapsed. I've heard of this happening when people have MS. Do you know why this happens?
Well, I have some theories about this. Sometimes, because there is an absolute focus on what was perceived as another fear or another danger, the amygdala and the insula and those other brain structures are purely focused on what is a huge event in someone's life, which is being pregnant and giving birth. And so those protective defensive responses switch off because they've got something far more important to be dealing with. Once someone then has a child and they've got over the pregnancy period, then the amygdala, insula, and other brain structures start going back to their default defensive responses. The second reason could be because there's a very big change in hormones and neurotransmitters, that could be offsetting the responses of the brain.
Someone wrote in saying that there are currently only 2 UK coaches and they're booked. And they wonder, are there any plans for additional ones?
Yes, we've got so much demand at the moment that we're currently training up some new coaches. And remember, we do have coaches in America and around the world who can also see people in the UK via Skype.
Someone said, I've heard that the DVD program is being revised. When will the updated DVD version be available?
As soon as I get off this interview.
No. Send it to me. I want it.
We're currently working on revamping it. So at the moment, we're getting feedback from patients. We are working with the coaches to improve the content. And we've got a workshop with the coaches in November to look at how we're going to make the next version, you know, even more powerful. So it's work in hand, but it will be sometime next year when it's released.
Somebody wrote in and said, I don't understand pacing. I've been more active by not focusing on body symptoms, but I still actually really feel them. Any advice?
Okay. Normally, when we have this condition, we start thinking about our bodies so many times a day, repeatedly, again and again and again. But what we are doing here is we are maintaining a rational perspective on what is appropriate to do. How much can I handle today? And then we continually break the negative thoughts whilst remaining, you know, aware of what is the appropriate level of activity. And it is an art rather than a science. So sometimes we'll get it right and we'll be able to do more things, but without pushing ourselves too hard. And sometimes there will be little dips. So pacing is all about a calm, rational assessment of how much activity is appropriate right now, and then not pushing ourselves too hard and having that awareness of, There's a little voice in all of us, and this is what we need to train. There's a little voice in all of us that when we are going beyond our boundary, there's a little part of us that says, oh, I'm feeling tired now. I need to stop. I need some rest. And that's often when our mind has become very busy and we're finding it difficult to concentrate because we've pushed slightly over our boundary. And at that moment, when we get that subtle signal that we need to stop because we're feeling confused and busy and a bit fatigued, we stop and we meditate to re-energize ourselves. So remember that with this condition, it's like the positive and negative terminals of a battery have been linked together. So as soon as we get some energy, it's very easy to drain the battery of energy if you push yourself too hard. And meditation is the way of re-energizing that battery as soon as you get the signal that it's getting empty.
Somebody said, I have no problem falling asleep, but I have trouble staying asleep. Is there anything in your program to help this?
Yes, so we have about half a webinar we spend on looking at sleep. So I'll briefly mention some of the things that people can help, that can help people with sleep. First of all, it's an evening meditation. So an evening meditation before dinner can definitely help towards sleep at night. Listening to one of our meditations before you go to sleep can help you stay asleep for longer. In the Meaning of Life app, we have a 20-minute getting back to sleep meditation. So if you wake up in the middle of the night and you can't go back to sleep, it goes through some techniques to help you drift back off to sleep. And people have reported their highly effective techniques. So I would definitely listen to that. For some people, a hot relaxing bath in the evening with lavender oil helps them. For some people, trying valerian as a herb helps them get to sleep. But the main thing is those last few hours before you go to sleep, it's very important to not be stimulated. So the last few hours before you go to sleep, especially after dinner, no tablets, phones, etc. It is about passive experiences rather than actively engaging your mind in those last few hours. And the most powerful thing you can do is laugh. So watching comedies on TV is probably one of the best things you can do, or laughing and joking with friends and family.
So in other words, you're not watching the crime dramas and being on the internet at 10 o'clock.
Yeah, or watching Fox News.
No, definitely never watching that. No. Someone asked, what conditions besides ME, CFS, and fibromyalgia can your program help?
Well, we've had success with IBS, which we believe is also a condition that follows this particular pattern, with tinnitus, with myofascial pain. We've had a couple of veterans from Gulf War syndrome who've reported positive effects with it as well. And we want to actually get into some research with the government on how we can, you know, get actual studies on this. So basically, it's any condition where there's a physical component to the condition where the doctors have said there's nothing more that we can do. You know, they generally tend to be what we call condition syndromes, neuroimmune condition syndromes. NICS is what I call these conditions now. And there's a broad umbrella of conditions which doctors can't really do anything for their patients.
Someone said, do you have any recorded meditations, especially to help with night terrors?
To reduce night terrors. We have no specific ones, but as I said, in the we have one to help you go back to sleep if you've woken up from a night terror. And secondly, if you do meditation or relaxation techniques in the evening, I do believe there is some research showing that you are less likely to get nightmares and night terrors and wake up in the middle of the night. And interestingly, when they do sleep studies, when people have interrupted sleep or they've had nightmares or whatever, guess which part of the brain lights up? It's the amygdala.
That's really interesting. Okay, so someone else wrote, are there any meditation CDs appropriate for children around the age of 7?
The language in our meditations is very simple and straightforward. And children can start meditating from the age of 7, 8 onwards. So there's no reason why they couldn't try one of the Meaning of Life meditations or something like that and see where it takes them.
Okay, great. Someone wrote in and said, I would like support on how to cope with severe anxiety and depression while doing this program.
Right. If someone has mild to moderate anxiety and depression, that's something that, you know, the tools can help with and, you know, one can do the program. But if you feel it's moderate to severe, then it's very, very important that you have support, that you have medical support face-to-face in your local area. So that's informing your doctor, working with a local therapist, etc. Because if it's moderate to severe, as I said, when we get to that stage, we all need a little help face-to-face.
Okay, someone said, do you ever see in patients that symptoms come back that may have gone away before? And can retraining trigger more symptoms or the return of old ones?
Retraining can only trigger new symptoms if there's anxiety with the retraining. So if some of our perfectionist or sensitive personality traits start latching onto the program and thinking, I've got to do it perfectly, or it's not going to work, or, I'm not doing it right, or whatever. In the agitation, we can make some symptoms a bit worse. So that's why we talk a lot about getting our attitude to retraining right. Now, let's say someone has retrained and they've got better and whatever. Yes, I'm not going to lie. There will be situations that if someone goes back to a similar situation that they had at the beginning of the condition. So let's say they're pushing themselves too hard, they're burning the candle at both ends, not getting enough sleep, or they are getting stressed out at work or in their personal lives. and then they get some kind of infection. They've recreated the same circumstances that triggered the original condition. And so once you get better, that's only 50% of the story. The next 50% is a continual monitoring of your own stress levels and your personality traits and learning to live with those traits and begin to moderate them and keep your nervous system calm. And that's daily meditation. It's daily self-awareness. It's going on this journey, continuing that journey of self-development. And secondly, sleep. You know, it is said by one of my teachers that actually 50% of conditions really come down to getting a good night's sleep. Sleep is one of the core reasons that we have pain and symptoms and lack of energy the next day. Our sleep is a finely tuned process. And the way to get good sleep is to get our sleep rhythms, our hormonal levels, our sleep rhythms in the right order. And the reason they're not in the right order is because the amygdala does not get relaxed, or sometimes is not relaxed enough by the time we want to go to sleep. And all of these tools and techniques, so the retraining, the daily twice daily meditations, the other tools and techniques that we've talked about, are all designed to get that amygdala as calm as possible in those last few hours before we go to sleep, so we can have a better sleep at night, so our healing parasympathetic nervous system can kick in and begin to do the healing that our bodies can naturally do. And that is an important part of the healing process.
Some of us are very creative artists, and we tend to love the late night hours. That's when we work. We feel great. It's the best time of day for some of us. So, and other people, as we know, are wired to be morning people. So my question is, when it comes to sleep, how to deal with these differences? And another section of this question is that many people dealing with CFS have extremely low cortisol levels all through the day, and they never even get into the normal range till after 10 p.m. So do you have any advice on this in regards to sleep?
I do, and I sympathize with that. However, it's creating a spiral, a downward spiral, because what happens is you get that energy surge towards the end of the day. You start doing more things, which is stimulating your nervous system, stimulating your mind. Then you find it more difficult to get to sleep, and your sleep is less effective, which then means that the next day is groggy during the day, but then the energy burst comes towards the end of the day again. And so I would advise, as tempting as it is to engage those creative juices at night, those last few hours are sacred, and it's very important to do everything which is gradually drifting your mind ready for sleep. And when you persevere with that pattern, and you know, wake up later in the morning, or you know, I often advise people to make sure their bedrooms are nice and cool, and to have an eye patch so that light isn't waking you up in the mornings, and have an eye patch so you sleep in for as long as possible in the morning to get as much restorative sleep into the morning as well. Then you'll find that over time the sleep cycles will gradually return to normal.
Someone said, when I practice, the fatigue gets better for a few hours, but then it comes back harder. Sometimes it even brings along mood issues. It's like a pushback. How do I deal with this pushback?
In the same way that you dealt with the original symptoms, which is observing them, using the retraining techniques, and letting them go. Because when you're changing something, the mind, the amygdala, may not like it because it doesn't like change. And therefore, it feels that there's an extra burden being put on you, or you're doing too many things. And you treat the symptoms in the same way, as long as you're pacing as well. So if you're doing a bit more activity, that's fine, as long as it's paced, as long as you feel it's appropriate without pushing yourself too hard.
Okay, great. Somebody wrote in, I live in a big city surrounded by achievers. Most of them have far worse habits than I do, and most of them never get CFS. So why assume that this trait has anything to do with it?
Okay, absolutely. Everyone has these traits to different levels, right? So the achiever trait, so we've got to be careful here in terms of looking at the intention behind being an achiever and being an achiever per se. They're two different things. Let me explain. There's lots of people out there who can be achievers, who go out and achieve things. But what is important is how much your nervous system is stimulated whilst being an achiever. That's the difference. And so what we find in these kinds of conditions is that people, being an achiever or what they've achieved or what they've done is almost life-threatening in the sense that their whole sense of self is resting on the outcome. They feel a real sense of attachment to how well they performed or what they've done. And so it's about the emotional dependency on what one has achieved or hasn't achieved versus being an achiever per se. So yes, we live in societies where there's a lot of go-getters, a lot of achievers, etc. And yes, their self-worth is reliant on it. And you might say, well, what? Well, they don't get these conditions. First of all, everyone has their cross to bear. So we don't know what conditions they're actually getting. They may be suffering from anxiety deep down or whatever. And remember that these conditions come when we are exposed to that kind of stress or anxiety combined with a specific viral or other infection or a chronic pain condition. And it's only when we don't take time out to rest during that period that then the conditioning effect happens in the brain. So it's a unique set of circumstances that come together to create these conditions. So it's not just being an achiever should mean I should get this condition. No, it's being an achiever plus the conditioning traumatic event in the brain that then causes the condition.
Somebody wrote, I find myself in a dip with a temperature, fever, flu-like viral thing. I've done stops, soften and flow on it. Do I just go to bed or do I do things... Go out and try to do some activities while I'm feeling this way? How do I know when to totally rest and when to try and be active?
This is really that pacing that we talked about earlier. We don't push through our symptoms. We take an assessment of how we're feeling and then what is the appropriate level. And we listen to our bodies. So if our bodies are saying, you know, I'm feeling really exhausted and tired, we do a stop to interrupt the anxiety which is attached to that particular message. But then we still pace ourselves. And so if you've got, I mean, I'm not sure in this particular person's situation whether the symptoms are purely coming from the condition or they actually have developed another virus.
Right.
If you get a flu or a cold, then you don't use the stop techniques on that flu or cold because that's something external. That's something different to the underlying chronic fatigue cycles. And once that virus has passed, then you can go back to the retraining. But if those viral flu-like symptoms are being caused by the chronic fatigue syndrome, then in the same way you would use the stop techniques, but not push your way through it. You would pace yourselves and take time to rest, and that's okay.
Now, how would this apply to people that are dealing with high levels of Epstein-Barr, maybe CMV, HHV6, or any other viral things that are kind of part of the chronic fatigue spectrum where they feel this way all the time?
What I would say is that by using the techniques step by step, the immune system will strengthen and the body's own ability to fight off opportunistic viruses and bacterial infections will increase. Yep. You know, many people go on these antiviral, drug processes or look at herbs and all of these different things. And they're all fine in their own way, but ultimately it's the body that heals itself. You know, medicines, etc., they support that healing process, but a strong body and mind is the best way of fighting off these opportunistic infections.
Somebody said, I'd like to continue working with my therapist, but how can I do it in a way that supports the program process?
As long as the therapist is not opposed to the Gupta program or teaching the person things which are very, very different to what's in the Gupta program, then that should be fine. I mean, any support that someone has face to face is obviously very beneficial as long as they are not contradicting what's in the program.
So in the program, anytime you have a thought about the body or the symptoms, you're trying to stop that versus in therapy, people are often talking about symptoms and things that are wrong. Does that contradict?
No, I mean, you're doing that for whatever, half an hour to an hour a week and talking through what's happening. So that would be the part of our emotions that we are releasing. We're releasing that fear during that session because we're with somebody we trust and we're able to let go of that fear. So that's fine. Then for the rest of the week, there's no point about us thinking about our bodies again and again. See, this is the delicate balance that we're walking here. At some level, if someone is unwell, then they have to learn to pace themselves in general in life. And so they will check in with their bodies a few times a day and think, okay, this is the appropriate level of activity. But people who have these conditions like CFS and fibromyalgia, they are checking their bodies and thinking about how they're feeling almost 24 hours a day. And even when we're asleep, the amygdala is constantly assessing that we're in danger and we need to defend ourselves against a virus, an infection, or pain, or whatever. And so it is that repeated awareness of the body which is what we are breaking. But that background, calm, rational assessment of what is appropriate, we can do that a few times a day and then pace ourselves accordingly and listen to our bodies. So we're both listening to our bodies and yet interrupting negative, repetitive thoughts about our bodies.
I like something you're saying here that I hope people are getting, or at least how I'm hearing it, is so the majority of time you want to be having different conversations focused on distractions, hobbies, and I know how hard that is when you're not feeling well, but that's what you want to be doing. You want to be kind of building these new neural pathways. You want to be focused on other things. But there is still that outlet and opening, say an hour a week with a therapist or maybe even a friend. I don't know your opinion on that. Yeah. But to be able to let out some of these other feelings and emotions, but then just make sure that the majority of time you're refocusing.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. It's a balance. You see, sometimes in therapy, we think it's one or the other. We think, is it we listen to our bodies or we don't listen to our bodies? And actually, what we do is we listen to our bodies, but we don't obsess about our bodies.
Someone said, I think we've sort of covered this because your program covers this, but I'll just double check for this person. She wrote in that she suffers from neuropathic pain as part of the CFS, and she said, Ashok has explained muscle pain and stiffness, but not so much what I deal with, which is the stabby electric shock type of things I tend to get in my arms and legs.
Right, and this whole area is, you know, a new area for brain neurology, and I've been researching some of these areas. And I'm sure people have heard of phantom limb pain, where somebody who's had a leg amputated or an arm amputated, their brain still processes signals from that part of their body, even though it no longer exists anymore. And they feel pain from a part of the body that it is no longer there. And we might, you know, loosely term that part of a family of conditions which may include neuropathic pain. And this is where the pain is being generated, or the pain signals at least, or are being generated and magnified in the brain as a result of the brain neurology. And I believe that that's what's happening in neuropathic pain and also fibromyalgia, where, yes, there may be some localized signals being generated in the body due to buildups of lactic acid and tightness of the muscles. Those signals are then going up to the brain, being highly magnified by the insula, the thalamus, and then passed on to the amygdala, where they are seen as negative. Therefore, the amygdala then orchestrates even more defensive responses, which means tightening up those very muscle groups which are causing those pain signals. So the whole system gets caught in a cycle of magnification of what's going on in the body.
I wanted to quickly mention, for those of you dealing with fibromyalgia, that there's a book called The Great Pain Deception by Stephen Ray Ozenich. It's based on the work of Dr. John Sarno, and it has helped a lot of people with fibromyalgia. If you're dealing with chronic pain, that's a book you should definitely check out. You'll either love it or hate it, but you know, check it out, because I do know it has helped many people. Let me kind of scroll down here. We have so many questions, so I want to see what
I feel like I'm on a game show.
I know you are. somebody wondered if you have refined any techniques. Have you refined any techniques specifically for MCS?
Well, as people know, if they're using the program for MCS, there is a separate video, an hour and a half video, which looks at how you adapt the techniques for MCS. And certainly at step six, we encourage people that what you do is you think of a food or a chemical that's similar to the one you're sensitive to, and you think of a memory in the past when you were exposed to that chemical but had no reaction whatsoever, right? And then you hold on to those good feelings, and then in the present day, you imagine something you're going to do in the coming period of time with yourself holding on to those positive, anchored memories of being safe around that particular chemical. And that generally has been working for people with MCS at step six. So it's training the brain that these chemicals and these foods are not dangerous for you. You may not choose to be deliberately exposed to it. We don't want to be deliberately exposed to petrol fumes or pollution or mold or whatever. But at the same time, there's no need to have a massive defensive response to those chemicals either.
I think that is such great advice. What a great way to describe the way to use the retraining process to help. So thanks for that. Okay, somebody said, I've been watching your free online videos. Have you helped anyone who's been ill with CFS or MCS over 25 years?
Yes, and on our website and the success stories, you'll see people's quotations of people who've had it 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, that kind of thing. Remember, just like you mentioned at 9/11, someone may have, if they were involved in 9/11, they may have a memory of 9/11 as if it's happening right now today, but it happened 14 years ago. Now, whether that memory happened 14 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago to the brain is irrelevant, because brain doesn't process time like that. And so if you had the original sensitizing event a year ago or 5 years ago or 20 years ago, it doesn't actually matter. What matters is the commitment to the retraining of that memory right now. We find that generally, on average, it's around 3 to 6 months for people to notice significant improvements, if not recovery. And then after that, we say, of course, if you've noticed improvements or you've partially or fully recovered, you want to continue with the tools and techniques. Now, there are some people where it does take longer than a year or a year and a half, but I don't want to talk too much about that because obviously, because our amygdalas are on high alert, some people will hear that and think, oh my God, it might take me 2 years, 3 years to get better from this condition. So what's important is you don't think too much on that or dwell too much on that, but instead say to yourself, you're on your own healing journey and it will take as long as it needs to take. And we say, if you've noticed improvements within 6 months, keep going with the program until you get better. So you don't have to give yourself a time limit. And even once you are better, so generally we say you get better when you're about 80 to 85% of your original health levels. Then after that, the last 15 to 20% is training yourself to get back into normal activity and back into normal life. And that process can take another 6 months as well.
Somebody wrote in and said, I have clients with the genotype. You're right. This does sound like a game show, doesn't it? I'm just asking, you're answering. Okay, let's try this again. Some people, she said, I have clients with the genotype that makes it harder to detox from mold, lime, and heavy metals. Have these people been successful with your program?
Right. Now, we know that, as we'd mentioned on our last interview, our genes are not our destiny. So whilst we might have a precursor to a particular condition, whether those genes then become active and how active they become are not set in stone and are more based on our lifestyle, our personality, our daily practices, etc., etc. And so although we haven't necessarily asked for people, we haven't done studies where we've tested people's genotypes and tested them against the program. I mean, that's something we'd love to do. What I will say is that just because someone has a tendency towards a lack of detox doesn't mean that they definitely will get these conditions. Because I'm sure in these studies, they don't say that everyone who has that particular genotype will definitely get MCS. These are tendencies. And so if we have that tendency, what's even more important for us is to keep our sympathetic nervous system calm down and to create more opportunities for our parasympathetic nervous system to detox and kick in.
Right.
So our bodies are our own best detoxer. And when our minds are calm and our bodies are in a healing state, our detoxification systems, our digestive systems, etc., are more effective at dealing with whatever they need to deal with.
Somebody said, my condition has been so severe that I've been bedbound, unable to move my arms or do the floor steps. How do I do the program?
So we've had people who've used the program when they've been bedbound by simply repeating the process in their head. The movements are there for people who can manage it, but you tailor the program according to your own abilities. And so what's important is to get the end result at the end of step six and step seven. But how you get there, you have to tailor to your own circumstances. So if you're bed bound, you can do it in your head. You can still do the meditations and breathing, and you can still look for opportunities to distract as much as possible.
Someone said, I'm in treatment for Lyme disease and I'm dealing with a lot of side effects from the medicines. Can I still retrain at the same time?
Now, this is always a difficult question for me, because if you are going through treatment for Lyme, which often makes the symptoms worse, then it's very difficult to retrain, because not only are you retraining the underlying cycles, but you're attempting to retrain physical symptoms which are as a result of the treatment. So generally, I would advise that do one or the other if the Lyme treatments are making you feel worse. Ideally, what I would say is use our program, and if you feel that you need further support and help, then maybe you go for a Lyme treatment. But if you're using Lyme treatment already, then finish that dose first and allow whatever symptoms are coming from the treatment to be back down to zero before you use our program. Because otherwise, you don't know. You could be using our program, but you don't know if it's effective or not.
Right. Or maybe there's other, you know, you can continue like the meditation. Anybody can do that, or relaxation videos, or even the accelerator technique, just to work on emotional things. That could be positive, and maybe not do the stop kind of process as much.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, you know, I think we have to be very careful with Lyme, because as I understand it, the treatments for Lyme are quite intensive and severe. And I did read this research a while back, so I can't remember exactly. But also, the outcomes are not particularly conclusive on Lyme treatments either. So, you know, it's all about really making sure you're informed of what you're taking into your body when you're taking these treatments.
Someone said, "How do I know what symptoms are conditioned responses versus which symptoms are things I actually need to pay attention to?"
Right. So this is what we mentioned earlier: that balance. It's okay to think about your body a number of times a day, let's say once an hour or once every couple of hours, to check in to see how you're feeling and make a calm decision as to what's your appropriate level of activity. So that's normal. But every other signal from your body is your amygdala and your insula trying to get your attention, because they're in a traumatic state of self-defense. They think your life is in danger, your body's in danger. And so they keep alerting you. And those are the patterns to break, so that eventually the amygdala and insula think, hang on a minute, I can't get this person's attention. So therefore, whatever we're defending against can't be that real. And we can't be in danger, because this person refuses to engage us. Therefore, we're going to switch off our defensive responses.
Someone wrote in, "I constantly feel like I'm burning up inside with sweats, fevers, chills, and fatigue. I've had this off and on for a decade, and I've been retraining for 4 months. These symptoms have not yet improved. Any help or advice would be appreciated."
Okay, so those types of temperature changes, night sweats, are all down to our autonomic nervous system. And our autonomic nervous system is essentially a system that should be in balance. So we have a sympathetic trigger, so that's stress, and we're designed to go back to normal state, where then the body heals and our temperature comes back to balance. Now, in these particular conditions, if the nervous system is over-triggered, if the immune system is over-triggered, then our autonomic nervous system is in a state of, it's a lack of balance, essentially. And that's when we'll experience these kinds of symptoms. And therefore, what I would suggest is continuing with the program, continuing with the tools and techniques, twice daily meditations. And if those symptoms don't improve, then looking to work with one of our practitioners to understand whether there's something specific that someone needs to do. But with those kinds of symptoms, because they're autonomic, there's, as I understand it, there's not a lot that you can really do to improve those symptoms, except for bringing your system back to balance.
Okay, and that's what the program helps to do over time. And like you said, again, some people get quick results and other people can take quite a long time. So just be patient, trust the process, and keep doing it.
Yes, and to give an example of that, we've had patients that have got better within weeks, literally back to 80, 85% recovery within weeks. And then we've had some people where it has taken 6 to 9 months to notice improvements. But those people have emailed me and said, "I'm really glad I took your advice to keep going no matter what, because now I'm getting improvements." And what we hypothesize is that for some people, once they start retraining and their nervous system is calmer, the nervous system needs to be calmer for a number of months for the detoxification system to be able to get rid of toxins in the body and for the muscle repair and healing to occur in the cells of the body, the organs of the body, for the energy to gradually come back. And we don't know which patient will fit in which particular category, but we do know that perseverance and continuing no matter what is the key to success. And the second key to success is when you get better, knowing that you have to monitor your lifestyle and your stress levels, and dips may come back, but just because you have a dip, that is nothing to worry about. It's simply that you need to go back to the tools. Great. Rather than thinking, I need to now do something different. As long as we've got all of these things checked out by our doctor and you can't find any obvious cause for our fatigue, then that fatigue is likely to be caused by nervous system imbalance. And if you, as you're recovering, you've had these improvements in these physical symptoms. For some people, the fatigue is the last thing to go. And it could be because actually there's still some background triggering of the nervous system, even though the obvious reactions have dissipated. And so I would suggest keeping going with the program. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's deeper and deeper levels of relaxation of the nervous system. So before, we may have had a stimulated nervous system, but our system could handle it and we could keep going and keep going. Once we get this condition, it's a wake-up call that actually it's useful to dial down our nervous system a few notches permanently. And the things that do that are sticking to a regular regime of meditation. And that's the important message we need to give ourselves, that as much as we think, oh, I don't have time today or whatever, meditation is just as important as, you know, brushing your teeth or having a shower. It's the most important thing every day, no matter where you are in the process of recovery, because it's the one thing that's going to really train your nervous system to be calm longer term.
And you're right. Sometimes you don't want to do it, and it can be hard to sit there. But it's so worth it when you show up and you do the process. I had one other comment I wanted to mention that personally I've just wondered if you would change it sometimes when you say, as long as your doctor can't find causes for fatigue, because for a lot of people, the doctors actually are seeing causes for the fatigue. Actually, I think that's probably true in a majority of people where viruses will show up. A lot of people have Lyme. A lot of people are showing mold problems. A lot of people are showing very severe adrenal. There's thyroid issues, all sorts of imbalances in hormones and neurotransmitters, minerals, vitamins. So that statement, as long as your doctor can't find anything causing fatigue, feels like, oh, but wait, that doesn't apply to me.
Ah, okay. So let me qualify what I mean. So those things that you've mentioned, if the doctor has a regime of drugs that you then try, but that doesn't seem to shift it, then that would mean that those symptoms are downstream symptoms of the underlying amygdala and insula issue. So opportunistic viruses and infections, we know that people with these conditions have those. We know people in CFS and fibro have a huge amount of opportunistic infections. Now, those infections may contribute to symptoms, but they're not the root cause of why these imbalances are occurring. And even in thyroid, I mean, I presented at a Thyroid UK conference, and it's striking because actually people who have thyroid problems display a large number of symptoms that are very similar to people with CFS. And there's many, many crossovers there. And we know that actually excessive stress and trauma can also trigger thyroid problems. So where, you know, what is the underlying cause and what is a symptom is a very difficult thing to fathom. So it's looking at what the doctor can do for you, but at the same time, looking at the hypothesis and thinking, what is actually the cause of this versus what is a downstream symptom?
So someone said, can Ashok explain why in amygdala retraining, it's not, the healing doesn't happen in a linear fashion? I would think that if I'm doing the processes and they're working, I should be getting better and better rather than going up and down all the time.
Think about the average person in the street. Yeah. Do they have a calm, centered mind all the time? You know, Our days are constantly changing. We're constantly meeting people in situations, challenges. Our own emotional levels go up and down during the day, our energy levels go up and down during the day, and we don't know what may suddenly trigger a particular dip in a particular day or a particular week. So the truth is that these things are, there's a whole range of factors influencing how we're going to feel mentally, physically, emotionally. And we can make an initial assessment, but we shouldn't become too obsessed or get into detective work as to what exactly happened or why. It's not X plus Y equals Z. It's an art, not a science.
Thank you for taking this long to answer all of these questions. Thanks for being on the game show.
That's okay. What have I won?
You won. So just lastly, I noticed the program is for sale now. I think it still is. What's included? Can you just talk about that money back guarantee, etc.?
Yes. So we have two packages available now. We have one package, which is including one of our workshops in London in November. And we have another package, which is currently for this month at a 15% discount. And that's a package of having the DVD program and the 3-month webinar coaching program. So normally that costs $299. But this month it's on at $249. And what you get included in that is the DVD program and the 12 weeks of webinars, plus obviously the membership site where you can access the forum, get into the buddy program, link with other people, and you get all the newsletters, etc. So we really support you through your whole healing journey. And that comes with a money-back guarantee that if you notice, you know, no improvements within 6 months, and after 6 months and up to a year, you can return it for a full refund, no questions asked.
So there's nothing to lose. The key is to do the program. And sometimes we think we're doing it, but we're not really doing it, or we're just doing part of it. So that's key. Commit to it and do it.
Yes. And I loved your phrase in our last interview, which was where you quoted me, actually. So this is quite narcissistic for me to kind of quote
yourself. But, it's okay.
Yeah, which is where you said you can't intellectualize your way out of this condition. Right. You might know amygdala retraining inside out and be an expert on it and have know everything to do with it, but it will not make an iota of difference. What matters is the practical engagement of the tools and practicing them repeatedly. That's far more important than understanding the intellectual background to them. And yes, you're absolutely right. In our minds, we might think, well, I don't believe it's going to work, or, oh, it's too much effort. And we make an assessment of the cost benefit. If I put this much effort and time into it, will it really give me the result that I want? And like anything in life, it's about trust and faith. Yeah. If your doctor gives you a course of 6 months of tablets that you need to take and says, you know, you'll get better from this condition, then you would give it the shot for 6 months and you would take all the tablets and make sure that you did the best that you could to get better. And in the same way, I ask you to just have that trust and faith, if you feel you fit the hypothesis, of just committing to the tools for 6 months, no matter how you feel, no matter what you want to do or don't want to do, and only judge the program after you've committed for that period of time, and then see what happens.
Thank you, Ashok. Fantastic advice. And thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. It's been great fun.
Have a great day. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much, Joe. Cheers. Bye.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And thanks for your questions. My name is Joe Davidson. You've been listening to Zentertainment Talk Radio on the web at zentertainment.org. You can sign up for the show and the podcast on the homepage and the show page. I hope you all have a great week, and we'll be talking again soon, so I'll catch you next time.